This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Spitfire by B.J. Allen. As a young pilot in Britain from the outset of World War II, he knows the phony war can't last forever. Soon it will consume the world in a fight against fascism. Spitfire by B.J. Allen, printed in Britain by Butler and Tanner. Publisher's note. The proofs of this book had to be passed for press subsequent to the author's departure for service overseas, 1942. It's a queer war. Everybody says so. The experts say it's going to be a war of attrition. Maybe that's their word for it. The Luftwaffe's expected blows on this island don't fall. The German Air Force's commander, Hermann Göring, contents himself instead by single aircraft attacking convoys around the coast of England. Time passes. My squadron has Hurricanes to patrol off the east coast of England, protecting a large convoy. A cry from the flight commander alerts us to an enemy raider. The Royal Navy spots the intruder too and puts up a barrage to drive off the enemy. March 1932 comes and goes. The Italian dictator Mussolini takes Albania. As winter falls, less happens in the air. But a few days after Britain declares war in September 1939, I go to a new squadron as flight commander, reluctant to leave my last very happy squadron, but I soon settle. Here the squadron flies Spitfires. Now we see in perspective the relevance of our years' training, the unending stream of new pilots, all those mock war operations. It's month after month patrolling, no doubt deterring German attacks without our seeing them at all. Knowing we're fully trained to face the grim reality of war, it's inevitable we'll soon find ourselves in the thick of it. And we do. In May 1942, on reconnoitering over the East Coast, B Flight goes after a Junkers 88 at about 20,000 feet. Forming a line astern, ours turn in to attack. The enemy's alert, puts his nose down to go hell for leather towards a layer of cloud at about 10,000 feet below, just before the Junkers reaches its relative safety. The leading Spitfire opens fire on the Junkers. As the enemy emerges from the cloud, the Spitfires resume their attack with a hail of bullets at close range before the Junkers regains the cloud cover and is gone. Word comes a Junkers ditching in the North Sea has crew claiming their rear gunner brought down one of our Spitfires. Not true, but he nearly did. As the Spitfires return to their airfield, one's late. Minutes pass with no sign of John, its pilot. To relief of all, the squadron hears a distinctive sound of the Spitfire, now nearly home from 30 miles out to sea. Physically, John's fine, but not his machine. We watch him land it, but the engine suddenly ceases. We rush over to where the Spitfire comes to rest in the middle of the runway, and the damage comes to light. Bullet holes in the nose and wings, and, most significant of all, in the oil tank. It ran dry. The homeward flight achieved with its engine having lost all oil pressure till it seizes up on landing. John only just makes it back. Our adjutant records the following in our squadron diary. First shot to be fired in anger by the squadron in the World War of 1939. Just about this time, we hear the squadron is moving to France at short notice with its Spitfires, their first deployment in a base outside Britain. But the command never comes. Our orders, instead, are to shift south to relieve a squadron already based there. as it turns out, will be in a position to help defend the Allies from air attack as the troops begin evacuating 300,000 troops stranded around Dunkirk, daring to embark from the sands of France onto a flotilla of vessels come to cross the English Channel. I don't think any of us realize what's soon to happen around this one-time peaceful gateway to the continent. Germans bombard Dunkirk. Trapped troops take to the beaches, while above one of the major air battles of the Second World War rages. It's 5 o'clock in the evening of May the 5th, 1941. We should have seen portent or grave danger in the grey sky as our squadron heads south. We navigate past numerous balloons of London's barrage. Each stands out blackly against the bleak, somber sky. It's getting dark as we circle to land, taxiing to our dispersal points on our new aeroplane, climb out and stand about, patiently awaiting the others to arrive. Here and there, cigarette smoke curls upward. So I'm not alone. As the Spitfire's engines cool, their exhausts occasionally give a crack, too. Otherwise, the only sounds are snatches of conversation in quiet tones. From a distance, it's sounding like a tractor that's towing a tanker, bringing fuel to replenish the Spitfire's tanks, preparing the newly landed aircraft at their dispersal points for the event of a quick takeoff. Our duty done, we walk over to the mess room. The departing sergeant quietly wishes us good night, sir, disappearing in the dark on his way to his quarters. Coming close to the mess, I hear muffled talking interspersed with rounds of laughter. Until now, it's been a peaceful evening of early summer. But that's an illusion. Over the English Channel, not many miles away, all hell's breaking loose in the northernmost corner of France, Dunkirk. Britain is yet to awake to the calamity wrecking that town. Along the coast, the Allies are reeling, their backs to the wall under German attack, with nowhere else to go. Air crew see it, looking down from above. It worsens by the day. We hear snatches of conversation. Miller should be back soon. I saw him put it down on the beach and get out. He's okay. Went into the drink. A destroyer picked me up. Luckily, she's going the right way. This from a pilot warmed by a blue sweater, trousers and monkey jacket kindly provided by courtesy of the Royal Navy on his being rescued at sea. As we walk in the door to the mess, my eyes blink in protest against the sudden light. I'm surprised to see someone I'd met at flight training school. He turns, facing the doorway.
Well, I'll be... Good Lord, haven't seen you in years.
Turns out that, since then, Ian has left the RAF to go to America in the years before the war, and here he is, now back in uniform. Surviving being shot down over France, he sets out to get back to his aerodrome in France, only to find his squadron's gone back to England. Eluding Germans, he reaches the English Channel to find a boat heading home. And so, here he is. My squadron's to assemble after the evening meal to hear the commander of another squadron based on this aerodrome tell us what we might expect from now on. It's late when we disperse to the barracks. I gradually drift off to sleep. I don't know about the others. I sleep like a log. We're all up and ready to take off at 0700 hours. The sun shines mistily through a cloud layer high in an otherwise clear sky, becoming bright in the dawn. We're a dozen pilots who regret eating eggs and bacon on excited stomachs. We'd drawn lots to determine who'd miss out flying on this first mission over France, as two extra pilots for the squadron drove down late to join us. When I reached my Spitfire, ready to go aloft, the fitters fussing around in the cockpit, polishing mirrors and windscreens, already spotless. with a pat on my shoulder as he goes to jump down to guide me out into the aerodrome, says, "Good luck, sir. See him off good and proper." His words linger in my mind as I scan the sky around me. We're two flights taking our lead from the CO's fighter up front, with another section of aircraft above and behind us acting as lookout. We set course for Calais near the coast of France. Cloud seems to be thickening there. We climb to 17,000 feet to begin a sweep to Dunkirk. At this height, we encounter straggles of cloud. The wisps shine dazzlingly white in the sunlight. Earth looks dark below. The English Channel has a splash of silver paint. After leaving England at Dover, we see ahead a great pall, black smoke, drifting a long trail from Calais over the water. The same terrible spectacle towers above Dunkirk, 50 kilometres along the coast. There's something infinitely sad about cities' destruction. I am held in a dreadful gaze, hating the humans who cause it. Over Calais, the CO turns, reversing our route going back to Calais. We're just below the layer of high cloud, gradually losing height. When suddenly, a formation of enemy Junkers 87 dive bombers appears from behind cloud banks. Their course will take them out to sea, and Britain beyond, unless our squadron destroys these evil-looking aircraft, like strange birds, with big spotted undercarriages and upswept wings, they fly on. Oblivious to our turning to position our Spitfires behind and closing quickly for attack. If any of theirs noticed our presence, it may be we are mistaken for the dive bomber's own escort. As our leading section opens fire, panic reigns with Junkers diving in all directions, breaking up their formation. I pick on one and stay on its tail through twists and turns. Yet the pilot's unable to avoid 8 streaks of tracer from my guns, sending a hail of bullets that none can avoid. The dive bomber pulls up, stalls, rolls over, plunges out of control towards the sea. I've often wondered what it is to down an aircraft. Now I know. It's exhilarating. I turn to scan the sky for enemy aircraft. 2 other dive bombers are spiraling down, and several Spitfires are wheeling about over Calais looking for fresh targets. I find one. Just beginning his dive onto the town, I plunge after him, firing at long range to distract the other pilot. He releases his bomb regardless, then flees at treetop level as I turn away. Regaining altitude over Calais, I hear in my headphones,
"Fighters! Fighters! My God, there's hundreds!"
It's an exaggeration, yet possibly as many as 50 Messerschmitt 109 fighters swarm into view. A burst of tracer comes over my left wing. I turn violently away as the grey-painted shape bearing the black crosses of the swastika flashes past. Only a fraction of a second later, an aircraft flashes only yards in front of my airscrew, the propeller. It's another of our Spitfires, hot on his tail. Everything happens at once. That Spitfire's got a Messerschmitt manoeuvring to attack. I switch my radio transmitter on, yell a warning, try to cut across and so distract the German's aim to spare that Spitfire, to the detriment of my own odds of survival. It's machine gun fire at the rear that tells me I'm in dire danger. Spotting 3 Messerschmitts, I begin to turn, knowing a Spitfire circles on a tighter radius than theirs. I have few options. My fuel is dwindling. I have very little ammunition left, probably only enough for a quick burst. And 3 Messerschmitts to 1 Spitfire isn't funny. The tighter my turn, the more the frustration of the German pilot, who occasionally fires short bursts as he strives to get his sights ahead far enough to hit me. This can't go on. I tighten still more my turn to stall the Spitfire. Roll over on my back and out into a reverse turn. It's a technique they teach us at flight training school. Seizing the initiative, I dive to the sea, flattening out as near the wave tops as I dare. Then open the throttle wide. Just as I begin to breathe again, Tracer appears over the cockpit. Bullets churn up lines of foam 100 yards ahead. Then I remember the engine boost device made for emergency. I push its lever down and feel the Merlin engine out in front of me surge with maximum power from my Spitfire as we twist and turn, avoiding bullets, but several times nearly clipping the ocean swells. One of the Messerschmitts evidently climbs to one side to press home an attack from my beam. I turn toward him, firing at point-blank range, the last of my ammunition. Still on maximum power, I pull ahead to look behind to see if any is following. I see only two of the Messerschmitts. Then, they're gone. I'm seeing white cliffs of Dover on the horizon, never a more welcome sight than now, as I throttle back, climb to clear the cliffs, and fly on to land at the aerodrome. Three other Spitfires are there to refuel. Barely do I touch down before the sky fills with the roar of another from the south, flying low to land. My crew come running, catching the wingtips as I taxi over, guiding the Spitfire to the tanker to refuel. I switch off. To reach the ground, I clamber stiffly from the cockpit to descend to a sea of faces. Of air crew, pleased, the Spitfire performs perfectly, and may do so again. Of armourers going at top speed to get the guns reloaded. Of pilots plying me with questions about the action. And an intelligence officer pushing his way through to hand me the green-coloured combat report form.
On the report first, please. You can talk to the chaps afterwards. I want the final score. How many did you get?
I got a Junkers 87. And I'm pretty sure I got a Messerschmitt 109 as well.
Good show,
he says, making a note of it. Slowly I collect my thoughts, trying to sort out the sequence of events. At last I've finished writing out my report. More Spitfires land safely. 10 pilots troop back to the mess, smoking and talking. It's sad to hear of our missing aircraft, one flown by our commanding officer. One of our Spitfire pilots believes he sees both missing aircraft spin down. Only one deploys a parachute. We count our toll on the enemy. 7 Junkers destroyed for sure, and probably 1 Messerschmitt. Groups of NCOs examine our planes for any damage done during the dogfighting. Their crews work assiduously, patching bullet holes, going over everything to ensure every aircraft taking off tomorrow flying on patrols of the coast of France is in good shape. One of our sections needs repairs to where 17 bullets tore into the Spitfire's fuselage. By noon next day, the 2 holes to my Spitfire's wings and 2 strikes deflected by the rudder are repaired and ready for the next patrol. It's noon next day, when a quick lunch prepares us for battle. 7 aircraft repaired, 2 almost ready. We congregate on the tarmac again. Without our commanding officer, it's for me to step up as acting CO to lead our squadron. Now 9 of the Spitfires are serviceable, we taxi out, then roar into life. Thunder of our Merlin engines taking to the air reverberates. The roar sustained as we circle, then wheel away to the southeast, climb to about 9,000 feet, where sunlight glints on our wings, a sky strewn with several banks of cloud. Supposing an enemy bomber intent on a target, we'll avoid going into cloud, lest the pilot lose his aim. We're holding that height over France, patrolling up and down its familiar coast. 30 minutes elapses. I scan the ground below for any bomb bursts betraying where a German raid is attacking the Allies' troops, trusting the cloud layer keeps our formation safe from above. That's where our lookout Spitfire's vigilance, from his position both behind and slightly above the others, raises the alarm. His RT crackles into life.
H measure, Spit, 109's right above.
Horrified, I turn my eyes upward. Where are they? I can't see them.
Right above us, about 1,000 feet. Look out! They're coming in. They're coming down.
They'd come out into a clear patch just north of Calais. I turn steeply to the right. The rest of the squadron spreads out in line astern. As I circle, I see a Spitfire disappear in a patch of cloud with a Messerschmitt on its tail. I turn to follow, but then its German pilot pulls clear of the cloud to climb away inland. I open the throttle wide to go after him, keeping a good lookout in case any more German aircraft should join us. None does. How could, half a minute before, 17 aircraft engage in a small patch of sky? And now there are only 2 of us. The German pilot obviously has no idea I'm just behind and below, close to attacking his aircraft. Carefully, I maneuver my sights on him, then slightly ahead to get the deflection. His aircraft lurches, falls over on its back, goes into a steep vertical dive. In case it's a sham, I roll the Spitfire to follow. Down, down we go. I wonder if he'll pull out. He never does. I think he's gone. Then realize he must have hit the ground. Still in a vertical dive, I pull back on the joystick, causing my head to thrust forward. My vision goes black just as the Spitfire levels out. As soon as consciousness returns, I head out to sea, ready to take refuge in a cloud if danger threatens. It's only gone 3 minutes since intercepting the Messerschmitts. Now I am astonished. They're all gone. No sign of any. Fuel's getting low. Crossing the coast, I'm heading for home, noting how sunlight catches the tower of Canterbury Cathedral. It's better to land now to refuel at a closer airstrip than to risk running out of aviation fuel while trying to reach our squadron's own base. I spot an alternative aerodrome to refuel my Spitfire, circling wide to pass close by another aircraft already refueling there. I check as I fly by the lettering on its fuselage, identifying it as one of ours. After landing, I taxi over to where its pilot parked and switch off. The other pilot's agitated. He says, "He's just witnessed over France one of our young pilots being shot down while trying to intercept the Messerschmitt that was then actually attacking my Spitfire." I'm able to assure him I eventually shot down that attacker. Another Spitfire lands, taxis over the landing strip towards us. The pilot I'm talking to looks as if he's seen a ghost. Speech fails us for a moment, as it dawns on us that its pilot we believed went down in the dive no one could survive is still alive and well, resurrected, so it seems, from the dead.
"Didn't you go into a spin when that German had a crack at you?"
"Oh, yeah. Once out of the spin, I searched the sky. Everybody had disappeared." One by one, more Spitfires come down at this airfield. Just in case, I think to phone our own base to see if any of ours have landed there. It seems not. That implies 2 are still missing. We fly off to our squadron's base to news that one of our missing planes has a pilot wounded with a bullet in his knee. Fearing he might not make it back to base, he had landed on a British foreshore at the first opportunity before risking blacking out from pain and blood loss. All save one of our squadron's pilots and Spitfires is accounted for. There's nothing more we can do than await further news. We take off for the short hop to be back at our own base. British intelligence, this is a big showdown over Dunkirk soon. We spend the next grey day, dull with huge banks of cumulus low cloud, impatient for action. By afternoon, all cloud departs, letting sunlight shine through, with every prospect of a perfect winter's evening. The RAF operations room phones the squadron with a different perspective.
"There'll be hell over Dunkirk this evening."
Exactly what we are to expect is unclear, for after the familiar takeoff and climb, rising above the aerodrome to fly in formation above the Thames estuary, all seems normal for our patrol. Till we reach the English Channel, seeing to the south a huge black column of oily smoke smudging the horizon, the nightmare of a nest of oil tanks burning. Once there, we change course to the east to patrol as far as the coastal town of Nieuport by the Belgian border. The sea shines blue beside rolling yellow sand dunes. Their beaches are about to write another chapter to British history, though we don't know it at the time. Anxiously, we scan the sky for a glint of sun on wing surfaces, or at ground level a flash from exploding bombs, indicating that the Luftwaffe's bombers are about. It's then I notice, just off the south mole of the Dunkirk harbour, three expanding circles near an offshore oil tanker. Frantically I search to spot the aircraft delivering these explosives, and I see it. Only one aircraft, but it's enough for an Allies anti-aircraft battery to begin firing a barrage of flak. We split our two sections, one to stay aloft in case this lone bomber be but a decoy. The other I lead to intercept the enemy aircraft. Its pilot spots us as he turns inland, attracting Agak still bursting near him. We're diving slightly as we overtake the enemy aircraft that turns out to be a Henschel 126 German two-seat reconnaissance and observation aircraft. It's relatively slow, but very manoeuvrable, which enables the enemy to twist and turn more than the faster Spitfire. In a magnificent manoeuvre, its pilot fights us off, avoiding the final burst by diving away behind me. I lose him. Feeling disturbed that it should draw me miles away into Belgium when our mission is supposed to protect the beaches of Dunkirk, I call up the section to rejoin the formation to continue with our patrol. We invite you to join us again next week at the same time, same station, for another edition of the story which is based on the book Spitfire by B.J. Allen, a book printed in Britain during the war, 1942, and subject to censoring that hides the identity of places and people. Nevertheless, the book Spitfire by B.J. Allen is faithful to the sequence of events that surrounded the unfolding of the evacuation of Allied troops in World War II from the beaches of Dunkirk. Till then, enjoy your week. Cheerio.
For episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.